At some point, the world just broke. That's what the elders say, at least. That it was like the earth was spinning and the sky cracked, and everything rushed out except the dregs. Not many elders left now, but there are still dregs. And where there's dregs, there's life. Of a kind. Parallel Lives is your source for atypical analog role-playing. This episode runs about 45 minutes long.
Hey, welcome to Parallel Lives. I'm your host, Wednesday Sophia, and today I'm joined by Charles, Hugh, and Carrie, and we are looking at Apocalypse World Part 2, A Tucalypse World.
A Tucalypse.
That's in the cave song.
B-pocalypse?
Yeah, Apocalypse Side B, sure.
That's a variant on Ribbon Drive.
Buzz, buzz, welcome to B-pocalypse.
No.
That's a variant on B-movie.
I'm sorry, I'm very silly right now, and I'm not sure why. Anyway,
we're all a little punchy.
We're decompressing. Yeah.
We just barely finished our campaign of Apocalypse World.
Before the
actual apocalypse began, which is probably a good thing, because things got pretty tense in our most recent session, and I can only imagine how tense they will actually get in the real apocalypse that we are currently facing down.
Topical? We'll see when I release this.
We're at the mercy of Wednesday's release schedule.
Yeah, the editing has to get done before they shut down the internet and ban all private media, so, you know.
No, we'll send them out in, like, floppy disks, like on the underground market.
Yeah. You can dial in with a 56K modem by phone freaking.
Yeah.
We're gonna do tape trading scenes again. My dream!
Just for you, Carrie. Just for you.
I love cassette trading. So let's talk about this game and not my fantasies of being a teenager in the 1960s.
Are you familiar with bone music? It's from the Soviet Union. They recorded, because they didn't have enough vinyl, they recorded music on x-rays.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's rad
really
as hell.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. Really, really cool.
I thought about trying to get one for my sibling. They're kind of expensive. But Anyways.
So about this game. We only have a cursory memory of what we talked about the last time we talked about this game.
It was a long time ago.
We talked about, I think, the basics of how the game works and the moves and how much I don't like it.
I think we touched on that.
Yeah.
As it turns out, we were able to get that feeling to full fruition by the end.
As it turns out, I don't like it, and I'm never playing this game again. I'm never playing any game involving Vincent Baker's stupid fucking abuse of two perfectly good six-sided dice again.
Ooh.
I don't think I've ever seen Hugh, as either game master or player, just lapse into, like, a depressive silence for about a minute and a half while trying to GM some of the scenes in this. And although I think I initially believed that it was entirely our fault, their fault, really, not mine. Sorry, my fault.
Completely Charles's fault.
I'm learning as we move past the game that the rule set had a lot to do with it.
No, I'm fully capable of depersonalizing my anger and directing it at this. The Apocalypse World isn't a game. It's a set of, like, 20 really pretty character sheets with some sort of free verse poetry attached.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened and where we ran into difficulties. Because this game actually had a really interesting sort of ebb and flow to it for me, where after the first couple of sessions, Hugh was irritated at the rules set, such as it is, and we were having some trouble figuring out, like, you know, what are we doing with the story? Wednesday's character and my character don't really agree on what's important. Charles's character has not a ton of, like, foothold in the town where we are, so, like, what are we doing? And then we had a really good session that actually Charles wasn't here for.
Coincidence?
Look, I'm not going to say it's impossible because, yeah, Wednesday and I just sort of went on an adventure. We spent the entire session trying desperately to avenge and or save one of my prostitutes at the Peacock. And I brokered a deal that ended up with some people getting shot that was really upsetting, and it was just like a really good session. And my character, October, underwent some character development, which informed their behavior for the entire rest of the game. And after that session, I was like, okay, awesome. We've got the hang of it. We know what we're doing. You seemed fine and to have had fun, and it was like, ah, we've hit the rhythm. And then we sort of desynced again, and our game ended with us running into all these pockets of the rules where the game clearly wants there to be intra-party conflict, but it's really hard to figure out how to do intra-party conflict in the rules.
Some rules have specific directives for how to apply them in the situation where they're being used on a player character. Some rules make no mention of it. Some rules don't mention it, but then there's a little bit of rules text buried somewhere in the rulebook that instructs you to do a certain thing a certain way. It's a hodgepodge of nonsense.
It's really frustrating.
Any individual part of these rules, I think, looks fairly elegant on its own. Like, this is a heavier weight system than many things we work in, but I never had to have the background information going in that, say, D&D 3.5, which is always my baseline system, even though I know that's, you know, decades plural old at this point. But the moment you start trying to put all of those parts together, you realize, yeah, like you said, you're not looking at a fully coherent set of rules so much as a bunch of small free verse poems that are like, ah, what if instead of a, like, spot check, we had two kinds of spot checks, and, like, when you succeeded at, you could only ask the DM, like, which enemy is most vulnerable to me, or what's the biggest threat, or what should I be on the lookout for, which is a fairly flavorful set of options for what your character would glean off a spot check in an apocalyptic setting. But then, when there are moments where that's not what you want out of a spot check at all, the rules don't have your back.
No, you can never ask a question that is, like, is someone going to betray me? What are the people's true motivations? Like, you just can't.
And while there's 200 pages of text in the rulebook, there's not 200 pages of rules in the rulebook. There's maybe 30 pages of rules in the rulebook. There's 170 pages of examples and exposition underlining various points about the philosophy of how to run this game. And, like, I'm going to sound like I'm contradicting myself here if you are a regular listener to this podcast, because normally, I love that. Normally, that's great. Normally, my one critique of a game ends up being something like, gosh, it could use some more example text in the rulebook to explain how to play clearly. The problem is, I don't think you could write enough example text in one human lifetime to adequately explain all the nuances, variants, and different ways that you need to creatively and in an inspired manner reinterpret the rules as written for Apocalypse World to cover all of the situations that will actually come up in one single goddamn game. The rulebook itself plays a kind of bait and switch on you by giving you these clear, straightforward examples that explain how to use the rule in exactly the context that the creator intended it. Now, this gives you sort of little islands of gameplay that's well understood and well supported by the game, but at the same time, the description of the setting, the characters, everything else shows you a whole ocean of gameplay potential. The rulebook makes it look like a space of potential games is much larger than sort of hopping back and forth between these little islands of things that are actually well mechanically supported by the game, and that's infuriating.
Can we come up with, like, maybe two examples of moments where the rules really let us down, we felt?
I can do one right off the bat. Like Charles pointed at, the read a sitch or read a person, and I'm not going to go to a specific moment from our campaign because that's not interesting, but the specific list of questions. There are situations where the answer to all of those questions is known to everyone. And yet the thing that the narrative needs is an element of randomness for dramatic tension as to whether the character understands or gleans something in the situation that could be critical or relevant. And yet, sometimes the answer to, is your character telling the truth? What's your character really feeling? What does your character intend to do? What does your character wish I'd do? And how could I get your character to blank? Are all the same thing or self-evident? And so you have this component of the game system that you can't actually use for anything.
I will offer one that was from us. We spent probably about, like, 6 minutes trying to resolve what would have been in, I think, almost any other game, a pretty simple skill check or an ability check or something. I was fleeing a cave. Carrie's character was in the way as I was fleeing and wanted to stop me so that we could have a discussion about some conflicts that had transpired.
And
we were looking for a way. You wanted to grab me and keep me from fleeing. And we went back and forth for a little while because the rules options that appeared available to us were either the somewhat like intuitive option, which was to seize something by force. But seizing something by force is a combat move, which is to say it begins with an exchange of blows aided by whatever weaponry you brought to the conflict. It is the sort of thing that the game clearly intends for use in, like, grappling with something that you may or may not be trying to kill on the spot. And Kara was like, I don't really want to do that, especially because I was like, okay, so I'm fleeing a battle right now. If you're trying to restrain me from that, I still have my weapon out. It's probably you grabbing me and me shanking you. And that's a lot to have happen for this moment. And so what are our other options? We alit upon go aggro on someone, which is a move where you make it clear what you want another player character or non-player character to do. And then, depending on your role, you can either make them force your hand and do whatever you were going to do, or they will cave and do what you want. Or, if you don't do as well, they'll get the hell out of your way, barricade themselves securely in, or, like, back off calmly.
And if you think about the situation here, where one character is leaving a narrow tunnel pursued by someone, and there's another character standing in the way, none of these options work.
None of them produce a medium-sized success-like state. It's like, oh yeah, no, if she rolls medium success, I guess I get the hell out of the way?
Unfortunately, I didn't roll a success, even a little bit at all. So we were able to quickly figure out, like, oh, well, what happens? Oh, I don't know, I get knocked over. Done.
And in some senses, that's my biggest complaint about this game. There's so much that you end up just having to make up. And if I'm gonna just be making stuff up 90% of the time, I don't want that other 10% of the time to be hindered by arbitrary and unhelpful constraints that make it harder to tell a satisfying story.
Yeah, it is not clear to me that anything past the character sheets represents an improvement in gameplay over the existence of the character sheets alone. And I'll clarify. I think that many people could, on their own, say, like, okay, we're going to play a game where we make up stories about fictional characters together to account for their various capabilities. We'll give them stats. And sometimes when those stats seem relevant to what's at hand, I guess we'll roll in some way based on those stats, and maybe we'll come up with opposed rolls, and we're done. And to their credit, a lot of the games we play basically stop at that point, and we've hit none of the snags in trying to mechanically work through situations that we hit in this. And again, I really like the character classes. I like the notion of the world. I think the abilities they give them are extremely flavorful. I'm still probably a fan of the too cool for school way that our characters are statted. It's not strength and charisma. It's how hard are you and how cool are you. These things all, I think, at a pretty fundamental level, work. But the game begins to break down precisely as it tries to do better at simulating things like, I mean, there's a vehicle combat section. We didn't use it. At this point, I'm pretty much grateful we never tried, because I don't want to experience what could go wrong with vehicle combat.
I would say, for me, there is a way in which I could see myself going back to this and stripping out a lot of the mechanics and trying to make it a much more story game than how we were playing it, and that might be a way that this would work better for me.
Dear listeners, let's be clear. These are the reactions of a group of players who have been playing in a reasonably long-running, like, a 7-8 session Apocalypse World game, run by someone who is, in many respects, struggling to run this game to the letter of the law. This game provides a lot of great infrastructure for a GM. There's the whole threat system. There's a notion of how you build the world populated with different kinds of threats, get at some of their motivations. It's a wonderful kit for building out an apocalyptic setting. What it isn't is any mechanics that you can actually lean on. As a GM, there's basically nothing in this game that you do that doesn't boil down to sort of just kind of use your discretion and do whatever seems right. Even the list of MC moves is basically just a list of advance the plot in some way. These are a number of obvious ways. Do one of those. There's nothing to work with here. Then when there's stuff to work with, it's just awkward.
What is the MC move list like?
The MC moves are separate them. Capture someone. Put someone in a spot. Trade harm for harm, as established. Announce off-screen badness. Announce future badness. inflict harm, as established, take away their stuff, make them buy, activate their stuff's downsides.
I'm going to need a page back for a moment. Which buy?
A B-U-Y.
Okay.
Make them purchase.
Monster Hearts is a half a yep. game away, and I just want to be sure that there isn't a, like, make characters bisexual move, because that feels, to be honest, completely honest, entirely plausible.
This is a game, and all the characters do have sex moves. Tell them the possible consequences and ask. Offer an opportunity with or without a cost. Turn their move back on them. Make a threat move from one of your threats. After every move, what do you do?
All right.
And to be clear, while there are examples of what those things could be in the rulebook, those examples don't clarify anything. And I think that that just covers literally everything you would do to advance the plot in a tabletop role-playing game in a violent and conflict-ridden world.
And it's nice to see it all laid out, but...
No, and I like that. It's a coherent summary of things you can do, but it's not a methodology.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vincent Baker... I'm saying this based on reading Dogs in the Vineyard, and to be clear, I love Dogs in the Vineyard. I love the Dogs in the Vineyard rulebook. That is a rulebook that lays out a clear methodology for how to run the game that the creator is intending. This is a rulebook that thinks it's doing the same thing, but is utterly impenetrable to me upon, like, my fifth cover-to-cover reading, and about 20 hours of attempting to run this game. So, maybe I'm a moron, but I give up. I don't think this is a good game. I think it's broken, it's bad, it's fundamentally flawed, and it's, in some respect, ill-conceived.
Is this where we talk about who this game is for?
Game is for no one.
Also, there are ways in which, because of the nature of the game itself, which is a game about taking things away from the players, making the life of the players and the player characters more and more difficult, there's a way in which that can be kind of a tough sell in the first place. And then in the second place, if you're having to struggle with rules and try to figure out, like, the stakes are ridiculously high on almost every roll, because there are lots and lots of rolls where if you fail, literally the response is, prepare for the worst. You know, the fact that you have to struggle with the rules just makes that proposition even less exciting.
So you got at something that is one of my more measured criticisms of this game, which is that because this game deprives the MC of any random tools, it forces you to always just jump on anything that furthers the plot, makes the game worse, etc., etc. That's both a good and a bad thing. My strong impression after playing this for a bit is that the on a miss, do something anyway but prepare for the worst is the best single written rule in this game. It appears on basically every move, and without fail, when that happens, the plot got more interesting and things got better. Do you guys agree? Because I felt pretty strongly that always moved the plot.
I do feel like that always moves the plot. Maybe
it moves
I just
the
need
plot
to...
by mean of bummer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, fundamentally for me, my plot in this game is I'm trying desperately to build safety. I'm trying desperately to build security. And the game doesn't want me to do that. And that kind of gets a little tiring. You know, you're trying to do that. You're making rolls. You're trying to be reasonable and succeed and so on and so forth. And on a miss, prepare for the worst.
This brings me back to the second half of that point, which is that because none of these things are, from the MC's perspective, at all at the whim of randomness, all of my moves are just do this thing. I never make any rolls. I don't make a roll to attack with an enemy. I just tell you that you got shot. There's no way for me to mitigate the awfulness of the world by assigning it probability.
No, there's
no
chance
to happen.
Escaping the rad scorpion.
Right. If I decide there are rad scorpions, well, fuck, you're gonna get stung by the rad scorpions.
I'm not sure how much we covered this in our last cast on this, but there are not really skill checks in this game in the way that there are in other games. You're always rolling 2d6 plus, like, a maximum of 3. So a flawless success is always, always, always 10 or more. Which means that you can never have a situation where it's like, well, you almost got it, so I'm only going to do, you know, 5 hit points of damage instead of 10 or anything like that. Or like, this is a really reasonable challenge and you probably should be able to pass it, so, you know, have a +5 instead of a +3. Like, you just can't do that.
Now,
I think I do see some of the ways that this game wants you to play around those things. Like, obviously the game doesn't want me to just ambush you with rad scorpions. It wants me to tell you that the salt flats are infested by rad scorpions, and as you walk away from town out towards the flats, you can see them scuttling there out in the distance, and so it'll be a dangerous march, and there's a chance you might get attacked, but do you want to go ahead and do it? The thing is, I can't say if there's a chance you might get attacked. I have to say, if you go out there, you'll get attacked by rad scorpions. And that constrains the player's freedom to make choices in many respects. It certainly constrains my freedom as a GM to make choices.
No, because the stakes always have to be incredibly high. So as a GM and as a player, you have to really pick your battles.
This is another way in which I think I failed at GMing this game, is that I don't think I was able to make the NPCs and the relationships between characters and NPCs and NPCs and other NPCs a detailed enough and lively enough part of this game. That's something it really wants you to do, and something that I in principle think is really good and really important in making a tabletop role-playing game. But particularly with only three player characters and a setting where those characters are all either already very close to each other or are already very far apart from each other, I struggled to build a dynamic web of characters that did that much to the plot.
And that's slightly surprising because, again, we focused our setting on a medium-sized town with a comprehensible number of sub-factions, each of which faction had a leader who we would meet on screen and talk to at least once or twice. And as far as how many characters we had in play and how much screen time we gave them, it seems like it should have come together. I don't think that this was a failure brought on by, like, an overly ambitious setting incorporating too many characters that didn't get enough screen time. Like, something else was in the works.
Part of that is some other person might have made pages and pages and pages of exhaustive notes about who all these characters were, tried to get in their heads, lived and breathed them for days and hours at a time. And maybe Apocalypse World holds up better if you have an MC who is really going to do that. I know people who love this game and have played in games they thought were great. I also know people who played in games that thought were really not very good and clunky and cumbersome and hard to understand and so on. But this isn't a democracy. It's our opinions that count. And my opinion is that this game is really not for anyone who doesn't want to sink hours and hours and hours and hours and hours into building the world in excruciating detail. Its frameworks don't make it easier. They necessitate more effort.
Which is super, super bizarre, because if you're the MC and you've read the rules, you're supposed to be able to sit down with players who haven't done any prep work themselves, maybe they know the system more or less, and just be like, okay, you guys, we're starting a game of Apocalypse World. Let's figure out how the apocalypse happened and just go from there.
It does say that there's preparatory work you have to do after the first session and then before each session. So that's not in the rules, or it's not radically against expectations, but in contrast to Dogs in the Vineyard, which has the best chapter on how to create a game setting ever, and while it does require upfront work, it produces something that is so elegant and easy to use and I think nigh on sublime in terms of game design. This is a mess. The amount of content you'd have to write to flesh out everything in this game to the extent to which it seems to think a thing could be fleshed out, giving it custom moves, custom threat countdowns, custom this's and that's. I can write an entire game system in that amount of time from scratch, with a coherent, readable rulebook that another person could play badly.
Yeah, I guess it just always feels to me like it does want things to be able to be improvised, you know, inspired, as you were saying. You know, where it's like, oh, prepare for the worst. Oh, great, you know, this is an opportunity for the GM to really make something out of this moment. I just do feel like there's a way in which that does kind of fly in the face.
I'm paging back over my notes to see whether there's anything else that I knew I wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to yet. And I'm realizing that actually a lot of it is pretty much ground-level versions of the larger meta points we've been making, but I wanted to have a, a moment to look at those a little bit closely. For instance, at a certain point, our psychic character got a bunch of psychic cronies. There are rules for having a gang, but there aren't so many rules for how to acquire them, or how many people, like, counts as a gang?
There are those. Is that correct? There's okay. Size categories for gangs.
Okay. But yeah, and we had another character who ascended to prominence with her place of business. Is she now a character with a holding? Does she get the benefit of holdings the way that, say, character class person with a holding, the hard holder, does? Or are those really mostly class specific? And again,
are we
like
misplaying? Are we playing the game wrong by allowing those things to happen without first taking those rules options?
Exactly.
Now, this is a flaw like D&D can have, too, to be clear, but...
Well, I said the word holding, and that brings me to my favorite subpoint, which is hold. A concept that I liked it when it was called strings in Monster Hearts, I think. Or at the very least, I thought it was an okay way to try and, like, represent social clout in a mechanical way for your teenage high school monster sex drama. This manual looks like it was written by someone who just gave him a little tingle in the brainstem every time he could type the word hold. Because every move gives it, and all of it is expendable. Like, so let's compare read a sitch and read a person for a moment. When you read a sitch, you succeed well or poorly or expect the worst, and you ask some questions. Cool, straightforward. Cool way for that to work out, makes sense. When you read a person, you hold either some or a lot, and you can expend hold to ask questions one for one while you're interacting with that person. Why on earth are we using hold to represent this? What makes this better than, you know, while you're interacting with that person, you may ask them up to 1, 2, 3 questions. Why is hold in here? And I'm still stuck on that, like, maybe Vincent Baker just loves the word hold, because a bunch of other abilities also give hold, but it cashes out for different things that are only relevant to those abilities. Like, he came up with a currency, flugelhorns, that every ability, it feels like, uses, but the flugelhorns do a different thing in each ability that uses flugelhorns. There's no ability, you can't use them like a real currency. It's a barter system, but every piece of barter has the same name. It's weird.
You people listening to this podcast, you're missing out on the best part, which is Hugh covering his face in desperation, trying not to laugh as Charles continued to talk.
Say flugelhorn over and over again.
It's really weird, okay? Baphmedads, like, could have been anything. He chose hold, and it sort of makes sense some of the time, but a lot of the time you're just like, why am I using the same resource in 3 different ways and 3 different abilities, but the resource always has the same name? Why?
Also, I've played this game with about 10 players. There is literally no one who has understood what +1 forward means.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
there are multiple people who have failed to understand it upon it being explained to them twice. And honestly, at this point, I've come to the conclusion it's just a stupid fucking abuse of language. And you're just using a word in a way, it's not even clear, like, what part of speech you're using. Is a forward a thing? Are they playing football? Are you sending a message on? Like, what is it? +1 forward? +1 what? The grammar of the way the rules for this game is written is literally painful.
And speaking of grammar, grammar tripped us up on another rule too. It's here in my notes. One of the things you can do when you level up is just get a second character. I've never seen that before. Seems real neat. One of my goals for this campaign was to get to a high enough level where I could take that level up option, because I want to see what it's like to actually have 2 player characters that you have to use.
Characters belonging to the same player don't have history with one another. History is
that's mechanically significant, yeah.
And can't help or interfere with one another.
And this is where grammar got us.
Help or interfere is a specific move.
Yeah, I have a move called help or interfere with someone. That's what it is.
It's not formatted in the text of the rulebook in such a manner as to make it clear whether they are referring to the move. You know, normally if you use a specific term of art, a specific keyword, it will be italicized or bold or something like that, so that you know that they are, yes, definitely referring to the specific keyword. This isn't. Now,
It's worth noting very briefly here that while I don't imagine that that's something that was going to be changed, the version of this that we have is a Kickstarter version, so it is possible that there are later revisions that maybe fix that kind of thing. I don't think that there were many later revisions past the one that I have shared with you all.
Yeah, but that's representative of a problem that recurs throughout the text.
Yeah, I would love it if this particular one were fixed. I'd be glad to know that we just hit upon something that literally all it would take was bolding or a parenthetical being like, and we don't mean the move. Yeah. This is very fixable, but I think it's reasonably emblematic, at least in the form that reached us.
And to continue with the rest of this paragraph, long experience has taught me that if you're going to play multiple characters, you should play each other's friends, not your own.
Which is a labyrinth of a sentence.
We still haven't parsed this one, folks. I don't know what it means. Charles doesn't know what it means.
Do we not? I thought we figured it out. I thought it was just you don't play your own character's friend because that way you're just not one person playing two people who are actually one person.
But then this is another instance of
a small
island of gameplay in an illusory wide sea of gameplay possibilities. That is such a stringent constraint on the narrative you can make. And, like, Charles wanted to take this ability. For that reason, we could not make that work in a way that was satisfying.
Yeah, we couldn't find another character worth promoting to PC status who we were dead sure satisfied either the narrative or the rules demands.
Yeah.
Because again, we could not be sure initially whether the character I came up with was one who would never help with or interfere with me story-wise. We could come up with one who just couldn't use that move on me. Sure, fine. It'd take some bending if we picked someone near to me who was on my side, but, like, couldn't be sure that we would satisfy the story rule. We couldn't be sure that we would satisfy the somewhat perplexing sentence about friendship.
And to be clear, this isn't an awful admonition. Yeah, if you're going to play two characters, they should be independent of each other. They should have their own things going on. They shouldn't be sort of just Steve and Steve's sidekick.
Yeah.
But that...
Now we're back to that noise. Did you have any more notes you wanted the audience to
hear? Yeah, I want to talk about some things about this game that I do like. And actually, ironically, a lot of those are also under the improvement section of the character sheet. When you level up in this game, real things happen. It's not just like, oh, okay, I get some plus ones to some of my stuff. Like, oh, you can get plus one to some of your stuff, but a lot of the improvements are kind of big. You know, they're things like, oh, you get a whole nother move. You know, basically you get a whole nother spell. You get a spell from a character sheet that doesn't belong to you. I eventually got an establishment and I got followers, which was a question where, like, oh, I sort of had those in-game before I got the improvements, and the improvements were just something where I was like, okay, now this is official. But they're super cool, and sometimes when you get them, you feel, like, accomplished. Especially if it makes sense, like, oh, yeah, no, it does make sense for me to become the madam of this brothel. Okay, I'll do it. And now my character sheet says that these are my followers, for realsies. Like, that's a cool feeling. You can advance your basic moves, and a lot of those advancements are really, really cool.
And it's worth talking about what that means. So you have your special character moves, which are your cool magic spells, your reality-altering powers. The Skinner can fascinate people by taking off clothes. The Brainer can learn people's deepest secrets. But when you advance the basic moves, you're advancing things like Do Something Under Fire, which was our catch-all for skill checks that weren't otherwise covered. Or you can advance your ability to open your brain to the psychic maelstrom, the advanced version of which move, I think, gives you access to the truth behind the world. Like, that's almost the rules text. So, you know, other people can roll their skill checks. They can roll spot, but you roll special super spot.
You roll something that will allow you to
reach through the world's psychic maelstrom to what's beyond it.
And that's super cool, and I wanted those things. I was like, oh man, I want these things real bad. This is a cool thing that I want.
You know, the key to that, just find a way to accidentally power level your character.
Yeah, well.
The leveling system in this game is you level up every 5 times you gain experience. And you gain experience every time you roll one of your highlighted stats. And your highlighted stats are chosen at the start of each session via a system of drafting that is probably about twice as baroque as it needs to be.
What?
But say, you know, when you read a sitch, you roll plus sharp. So maybe just you spend that day, every time you change scenes, you read the sitch. win, lose, whatever. And there's a cool tension here, which is every time you roll the dice, you're gaining experience. But every time you roll the dice, you're gaining a chance to fail catastrophically. I was definitely a character who rode the roll dice almost as often as you can pony. And for my trouble, I nearly burned a couple of people to death a couple of times. And that's actually, I think, a fairly cool bit of balancing. But yeah, like, you can just sort of, if you can find a way to roll dice a lot, congratulations, your character levels up, like, really fast, and you just leave the rest of the party in the dust. And this is not a system for munchkinning. It's not a system for power gamers. There is a way where if you die the first time, it's basically a buff. Like, don't go to this looking for a system to play competitive dungeons. It's not. But, like, it is oddly balanced, even with that taken into account.
The power leveling strategy I found the time I played Apocalypse World was to do something under fire repeatedly.
Yeah.
If you have cool as your highlighted stat, you should be able to get, like, two levels.
No, it should not be a problem. Which is kind of cool, because it means anytime you're really, like, doing a bunch of stuff, you're leveling. And, like, that's cool, and it feels good. And in practice, Charles had a moment, it was just really, really well timed, where Charles's character had a turn where he became significantly more villainous. And that turn involved him rolling his stats over and over again. So he just leveled into villainy at exactly the moment that the narrative would want that from him. And, like, that was pretty cool.
That worked, but it could just as easily have been, like...
It could just as easily have been dumb.
So, you know, we, the adventurers, took a week off, and I spent that week off doing Activity X where X rolls a stat.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I mean, I think any responsible MC wouldn't allow that.
There is a balancing factor here called the look your friend will give you, but...
Yeah. Well, there's a larger balancing factor, which is that this is a game that does have an absolute narrative authority in the MC to some extent, and I can side eye you pretty strong if you're not playing.
Let's be clear. The day that I ended up rolling my stat 12 times, I was like, I think we could just bundle this up to like 3 rolls and call it good. And he you did it 12, we're doing it 12, let's play all 12, let's go.
Which I did, because there was a specific interesting story consequence for you failing.
Yep.
I also want to say that one of the advanced improvements, so you can't get this until you've leveled a certain number of times already, but one of the advanced improvements is retire your character to safety, which in a lot of ways is just win. That character gets to have won. Good job, victory march for that character. And I think that that's a really cool thing to just put on a character sheet for somebody to aspire to. Like, I really think that the improvements are genuinely cool, and they feel good, and they were things that I desired.
I think that's been pretty consistently the reaction of everyone I know who's played this game, me included.
Yeah. No,
I'm real excited about all the level up options I got. They're all really good feeling.
No, and some of them were super duper useful. Like, I took a move from another playset that totally just radically changed my effectiveness in a lot of situations.
I gained phenomenal new psychic powers from other less psychic classes.
So, I think we've said most of what there is to say.
Yeah, Wednesday asked earlier, would we return to Monster Hearts? I think I would return to Monster Hearts, although I would not return to this game except to maybe, like, just steal the character sheets. And the difference is just, like, Monster Hearts is fundamentally a game where you're in a high school. This is fundamentally a game where the stakes are so much higher. And I enjoy that a lot less.
I think, for my part, I would also go back to Monster Hearts. And part of that is, again, that it's just that high school setting, maybe? I'm not sure if it was just that we didn't play as much Monster Hearts as we did Apocalypse World, so we didn't come to this point of being as frustrated with the mechanics as we did in this instance. But it felt to me like something to do with Monster Hearts being more about your characters kind of dicking around really worked for me in a way that these mechanics were just there to support that, and most of it was just socializing. Whereas this, when we went on to socializing, it just felt we had interminable conversations where we decided if we were going to shoot each other or not.
Yeah, there was a real way in which the conversations in this were not as rewarding as the ones in Monster Hearts, in part because this game takes a pretty hands-off approach to what sorts of conversational moves can be used on PCs when, or it at the very least tries to. There's a hole in that system that we did encounter, but I would go back to Monster Hearts, but I would go back to it with fear, because we reviewed Monster Hearts after one session, and we tried to structure it for that.
It was 2.5 sessions.
It was 2.5? Oh, fair enough, that's true. But we didn't play out a whole campaign in it. And I worry that we would find the same sorts of rules lacunae in that if we went back to it that we found in this. I wonder if I just have a vision of it tainted by my experiences in the direction of loving it.
This is not directly about Monster Hearts, but in response to something you mentioned, long conversations about whether or not you're going to shoot each other. That's, I think, sort of my fault in that I wasn't able to do a lot to get you guys to ground your conflicts in third parties. Like, it's easier to have a conversation about I'm going to shoot Susie over there rather than I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah.
Because then the stakes between the two players themselves are a little bit lower. So there are ways that could have been better. Our example of inter-party conflict was not a great one. Or it was one that played entirely on the weaknesses of what this game has, rather than the ways in which the game does generate some scenarios where those conflicts come up but are meaningful and interesting.
Also, the conflict that could most easily become I'm going to shoot Susie versus I don't want you to shoot Susie was short-circuited down somewhat to I want to shoot you, I don't want you to shoot me, because Susie ended up living literally inside the body of a PC.
Yeah, I became Susie.
So a conflict that could have ended up centered outside ended up centered, again, on a player character.
It's the apocalypse, shit happens.
Yep.
To be fair, that's partially because you shot Susie.
In part, because, I mean, Susie shot me and I shot back.
First.
Yeah, so who is this game for and who is this game not for?
It's for no one.
Yeah, honestly, there is a big part of me that thinks if you really want to play this game, just play Monster Hearts or just play another system that you're already comfortable with and steal these character concepts and figure out a way to work the totally cool and rad character progression into another game.
I think if you're a person who is interested in homebrew kind of thing, if you're interested in taking game rules and ignoring some and using other ones and writing stories and weaving tales together, and then you want to use this for some of it, I think you can do it. I don't think I would say it's your first game necessarily, and I wouldn't say that it's one that I could 100% recommend, though.
I know how I would beat Apocalypse World into shape as a game that I actually wanted to play. I will also credit the rulebook for giving you actual instructions on how to create new moves that are of the same kind as the moves that are in the game, and to, in fact, encouraging you to do it sort of as you see fit in a wide-ranging and, of course, very non-specific set of scenarios. I find that the way I run games is to make rulings and judgment calls on the fly as the game is happening, rather than to sit down for an hour beforehand and write out three new pages of rules text. If you like sitting down beforehand and writing out three new pages of rules text, this is a great game for you, and if you play it for like four sessions as is, you'll discover all the ways you want to change it, then you'll make those changes, and then you'll distribute to all your players your 20-page addendum of new rules for Apocalypse World, and you'll play a different but related game that will work quite well and will have all the positive things that Apocalypse World provides. And along the way, you'll have captured sort of the gestalt essence of the game that you want Apocalypse World to be. And you'll make that game and you'll play it.
Yeah. My main point is, even if what we played was a bit of a mess, I think there's enough interesting stuff in it that you could take it apart and put it back together and get something. There's salvageable material.
My who the game for is for is pretty close. I think it is people for whom the thematics of Apocalypse World as a kind of setting are extremely important. Because at a certain level, the aesthetics work. The moves you have to work with tilt in the direction the story wants to go. The character concepts tilt in the direction that these sorts of stories are comfortable going. And I think those are things to love about it, but I think that you would have to take it and bend it and build on it in pretty much the ways Hugh was talking about before you can come up with a game that I think I'd be totally satisfied with.
Now that said, I think we're running a bit low on time, so we'll have to forego the Sex Versions, the Aphex Twins, and any further primes for this week.
They're all just Monster Hearts.
This game is its own Sex Version.
Dear listeners, you mean the world to us. See you next time. Again, thank you for listening to Parallel Lives. If you want to find the show online, we're at parallelurl.com, parallelpodcast@gmail.com, or the Parallel Lives Tabletop Podcast on Facebook. Review us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher Radio if you'd like to help us get new listeners. Once again, you can find Apocalypse World at apocalypse-world.com. If you'd like to find us on Twitter,
The podcast is at Parallel Chat, Carrie is at Baroque Emotions, Hugh is at Ionic Brother, Charles is at Gush4U with the number 4 and the letter U, and I am at Wednesday Quest. This episode is produced by me, with music by Kevin MacLeod. Next week, Parallel Lives brings you the final word on higher education, as we take on the Shah Belhiri Roach. That episode comes in at about an hour.
I realize a name for Charles's Shining Lights segment, we could call it Positive Lives.
Did I have a Shining Lights segment?
Yes.
I forgot about that.
We should have those!
We should record this podcast more than once every 6 months.
We've only used it twice, I think. Once Endurance, and you're like, well, that's a new edition, let's do this every episode.
Can I have a Things I Fucking Hate segment?
That could be negative.
I feel like that was all of it.